I'm going to be actually just assisting you in having a discussion tonight together with the title, On Earth as in Heaven, Can the World Afford America? And thinking about this forum, what I was trying to do was to summarize some of the week's discussions around topics like the environment, human relations, the diversity issues that we've discussed this week, gay and lesbian issues, race and gender as well, and issues of our own consumption of world resources. I have a few discussion starters in mind, but I would really like us, would like you to take responsibility for the evening to get it going. But for a couple discussion starters, I have a piece from what's called the Utney Reader. For those of you that are familiar with that, you know that that's just an excellent piece. If you haven't seen it, it's in the resource room. In each issue of the Utney Reader, there's something called the back page, which is just a snapshot of information that I find unusually helpful and exciting at times in terms of managing information. The one in the last issue was entitled The Global Village. And it's based on the premise, if the global village were 1,000 people, then what would be the demographics of the village? And first it does cultures, and then it does religions. But in particular, I'm interested in the economic piece of that. And I'd like you to take some guesses. If the global village were only 1,000 people, how many do you think would control half of the income? How many would control half of the income of the global village?
50.
Close, 60. 60 people out of 1,000 would control half the income of the global vision, of the global village. Can you see that?
Perfect. Yeah.
Okay,
good.
Thanks. Okay, 60 people control half of the resources in the global village, if it were a village of 1,000 people. Take a guess about how many would be hungry. 500 would be hungry. How many would live in shanty towns? Do we all know what a shanty town is? Okay. Someone say no?
200 to 300.
150.
600. Six 600 out of 1,000 would live in shanty towns. Would someone describe a shanty town? What's a shanty town?
Housing unfit for living.
Okay. Where do we see examples of that?
Oh, large metropolitan areas.
Okay.
Washington, D.C.
Okay. I oftentimes think of Soweto in South Africa. How many would be illiterate? 700. This is helpful to me when I ask the question, can the world afford America anymore? Let me just, one other discussion starter here. Some would say that, therefore, all we need to do is to have the third world, and I really dislike that term, become more like the first world in terms of its economic resources. So let's take a look at that. Let's say that 5% of the world's population consumes about 40% of the world's resources as it is now. And what we'd like to do is to raise this number. We'd like more people consuming at the level of consumption that those of us in the Western world consume, especially in the United States. So let's just add 5% to that. Let's bring 5% more up to our lifestyle. Now, and excuse this simple analogy, but again, I think it's helpful. Let's say that 10% of the people are now consuming 80% of the world's resources. And we really like doing that. You know, we've got 5% more of the people in the world feeling as privileged as we are, so let's do it again. So now we have 15% of the population of the world consuming, 120% of the world's resources. you know, even though Joe Jordan isn't here, I can tell that we've got a problem. So, discussion starters. Here's a glimpse of the Global Village. Here's one simple, yet I think rational, look at why it might not be possible to raise everybody to our standard of living. So it calls me, actually compels me to ask the question, can the world afford America any longer? What I'd like you to do would be to turn, we're going to try to respect one other bit of diversity in the village this time, and that is the diversity of learning styles. If I were to just open it up for discussion now, those of you who need a little bit more time to process what you're thinking and feeling would be kind of outgunned by those of us who think while we're talking. So what I'd like you to do is to take a couple minutes of silence if you prefer, talk to a neighbor about what you think, and after we do that for about 2 or 3 minutes, we're going to open it up for a larger discussion. Go ahead. Talk to a neighbor if you'd like. Okay, why don't we open it up? Picture yourselves having a conversation with each other in your own living room, and someone start us off. Can the world afford America any longer? Anyone want to give that a shot?
I'd say no. If the world would give a sincere effort to attack problems such as injustice and poverty and things like that, it cannot afford America's style any longer. It would have to change somehow. I don't have a plan. I don't know if anybody does. But the answer is no, it can't.
Okay. What do others think? There's a vote no.
My thought was, can America even afford America anymore?
Good question.
The gap is getting so dramatic in America.
Good perception.
Well, I think that we give so much foreign aid to all those poor countries and they don't even appreciate it. And as a Christian nation, we're being blessed by what we have and we're called to be good stewards of that. But where would the world be without America? I mean, we're the leaders of the free world.
Yes, great.
I just read the name. Did you read that today? I just read in the paper that Japan just surpassed us this year. So we're not going to be important. But we do spend a lot.
Okay, I think the point that Dan's making is that it's, you know, American ingenuity, it's American know-how, kind of inspired by American capital that's made the world a better place to live. What do you think?
I'm sort of tired of agreeing with everyone, so I'm going to place for fun and be a devil's advocate and say that America has superior technological abilities and we've given so much to the world that we have to continue with our capitalistic way of life to keep making technological advances, to keep improving the quality of life.
If I would summarize what you said, you would be a believer that science will save us.
Yeah.
Okay? All right. What do you think?
science will say that the science need overconsumption to be science.
What else would it be? Explain how it would be different.
I just don't think that we need to have the high levels of consumption in order to create science. People could, good ideas come out of your mind and not necessarily out of, you know, living in opulence. And so,
so you're saying
I think they could be divorced.
We can have simplicity and science?
The first thing that came to my mind is, how would anything change? I mean, we are so bent in the United States and in the whole world to consume that it's hard for me to imagine people giving that up for anything. And the only thing I could think of is that there would be like a catastrophe that you have to give things up.
Can you?
It's coming.
Can you think of an example of a catastrophe that might change behavior?
Well, I don't know. There's all the environmental, whatever, you know.
Comment over here was that it's coming. Who was that? Talk some more about that.
Well, just global warming and ozone depletion and all that. In this country, you know, we've started to do some things. I mean, indeed, you know, after the first earthquake, we started to do something.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, a lot of our air was cleaned up by switching to nuclear power in a lot of areas, like where I'm from, Chicago, is nuclear power. And so the nuclear industry, well, the electric company there ran this real glossy ad campaign about how, what a difference a day makes, and how they've done all this, how the air had been cleaned up. And we when East Germany and Eastern Europe opened up, we saw that there's industrial areas there where they continue to burn the high sulfur coal. And there's areas there where in the industrial valleys where cancer and mental illness and everything is six times as high as the national average. You know, the evidence is in that it's killing.
Okay. So you would argue that our lifestyle is killing us, that the disasters are upon us, in the back.
When you're talking about crisis, it just occurred to me that the oil crisis, we have a shortage of the fact that everyone's driving and the gas. That could be an example of something, you know, possible crisis that could affect in the future.
I'll vote for that one, and I was just going to say the main crisis that gets people's attention is one that costs them more a day. Something like the raising of the price of gas. That got people's attention. What else can we come up with that'll get their attention like
so
that?
So one of the best ways to get us to respond is to hit us in the pocketbook, okay?
But I think that the kind of crisis at what the road that we go down before we go down the road towards making significant changes, as we go down a road towards more repression of other people and more taking away the resources from them. I mean, I think that, I mean, it's hard for me to even think of, even if we have something catastrophic, it seems like we'll just take more from the weaker people. And that's the figure I have.
Thus far, you know, the cornucopia has been filled by other people's plates being empty. I mean, what you're saying is true, that we have a cornucopia of choices in this country, sometimes because there are people who are starving. Carl.
Well, I feel that actions are really much stronger than words, and I feel that we can, you know, say yes, we can't warn ourselves, but yet when we go back home, what are our actions going to say? I mean, are we going to continue as we are now, or are we going to make changes? And I think that's what's important, is our actions, not our words.
If Dale Pitcher is here, I think he's probably doing handsprings with that. Dan?
I think that there are at least two things that are really tied together now. One is our patterns of consumption. And those we can have to change at the personal level and the societal level. other one that is equally, if not more frightening to me, is the militarization that is put in place to protect us not having to change that consumption patterns. And I agree with Lori on what I still fear. We have so much military power, and I think that so oftentimes, rather than change the patterns of produced crises, we project our military power and our economic power to shield us from having to do that by repressing other peoples. And my fear is, as the crisis gets more acute, that will there'll be more and more attempt to look for scapegoats and to use that military and economic power to project outward on other people rather than looking inwardly at ourselves.
So unless we begin to change our appetite, we'll find more and more effective ways of maintaining the flow of goods and resources we need to keep us. Yeah.
So to pick up on the second half of what Danny said about, I think that what we're talking about is north-south relations, basically white first world developed countries and less developed countries. And so when you talk about crisis, is that crisis going to happen? And when you look at certain population increases in Africa and in Asia of generally brown-skinned people, is that crisis going to happen, and how are we going to deal with that? Will it be to, like other people said, blame these countries for wanting to develop the same way we developed by cutting down their rainforests, by exploiting labor, just as we did in our history? So is that crisis coming, and what will we do with it?
Good question.
I think of even right now that things are already changing in the United States perspective as the biggest consumer of goods. And what I'm talking about is how, for example, the two largest areas of growth in jobs, specifically in the service sector, are custodians and security guards. So what's happening is the United States is becoming the next largest third world nation. And I see, as the middle class is eroded, and just last week, wasn't it that Bush was talking about free trade agreement with Mexico? Then the middle class jobs that have been the providers of basic family type values in the United States, those incomes will be gone as that kind of stuff is produced in other countries. So there's a redistribution of wealth right there, but who's having to pay for it? Mm-hmm.
If we were to use the infamous misery index, which helped presidents to get in and out of office a few years back, we have to be careful, I think, in doing an internal comparison in this country with rich and poor in the misery index, and applying that same model to first world, third world differences. I mean, they really are phenomenally different. The lifestyle between rich and poor in this country is significantly different between poor and poor in a third world country. Dan?
But what I'm hearing is that international corporations and the class that run them are willing to sell out the U.S. middle class,
okay,
as well as anyone else, to keep that global control going, which is what we're entering into now.
Okay, good point. I see the point clear.
Yes, I think I think capital will flee to other nations where you can get $2 or $3 an hour labor. Undermine the whole labor structure of this country with all of its benefits, Social Security, Medicare, all those things are going to go. And the people who have capital will be rich, and the rest of us will be poor everywhere, not just in the third world.
Did a person named Karl Marx a little while back predict this? Just a question. Was there a hand over here? Yeah.
What significance is there, looking back historically, to our country being founded on Christian principles? Most of our forefathers were Christian-believing people, to today's state where it's essentially separation of church from state.
One of the most for me, troubling statistics that I heard, and I can quote the source if you press me. I may have it somewhere back in my room. This was a study done in England, and they said that of the world's resources, that 65% of the control over world resources are in the hands of Christians. 65% of the control of world's resources are in the hands of Christians. And I think really just jumping off on your point, you know, if that's true, why is there hunger and poverty and injustice if majority of resources are in the hands of Christians?
If I could just, I was sitting here trying to think what difference it would make to me if we took some of this seriously. For example, one of the statistics that I read is that the U.S., with roughly 5% of the world's population, consumes 46% of the resources that are used in 1 year. And I want to broaden a little bit to say that North America is in the same bracket. I was thinking of driving down here from Edmonton, okay? Mm-hmm. We decided to bring two cars because there were six of us. Could have brought one car, we brought two. And we decided, first of all, to go out of Edmonton, east a ways to go to a funeral. That consumed 180 miles, roughly. Then we roared down here and consumed a whole lot more gasoline. And I was trying to think, and then last winter, it was 40 below several days in Edmonton, wasn't it, Roy? You know, and we heated our houses, and the houses have gotten much bigger in the last 10 years for the same size family. For me to take that seriously as a North American would mean some major changes in my lifestyle. And I'm really asking myself, am I willing to make those changes? If collectively North America is using 50% of the world's resources, there's something dramatically wrong. They can't afford North America, I mean, not just America, but North America.
Okay. Excellent example. Thanks for the personal example. If I'm missing people in the balcony, shout at me.
One thing Susan said at the very beginning was we were talking about, do we see anyone, any group of people willing to change? I mean, already changing. Are there any communities anywhere in this country where people have decided that we're going to live simply? I mean, there's not even any large movement, you know, towards people eating simply one day of the week, or voluntarily cutting back 5%.
Well, I think that's an excellent point to dwell on for a minute. Why do you think that is? I have a hunch. Go ahead.
Another thing, about a month ago there was, in the news, there was a survey that they were asking Americans about raising taxes, and they thought it would be a good idea to pay off the national debt. And 80% of the people said, yeah, we need more taxes, yeah, we need to pay off the national debt. And then the last question was, are you willing to pay more taxes? And 3/4 of the people said no. So we can know the right thing to do, but not when it actually affects us.
Let me jump off on your first point and just play, you know, discussion stimulator here a little bit. One of the reasons why I think that we as citizens in the United States or Canada don't do that is because we're afraid of simplicity. As citizens in a capitalistic country, our self-worth is connected to our productivity. I am what I produce. And as a matter of fact, that was the logic, this is my interpretation now, in the Reagan administration, that allowed them to see children as less important than productive older citizens, and therefore for children, ketchup and mustard would be vegetables. You see, if you're not as productive as other citizens, then your self-worth is not as much, nor does the country owe you as much. So my hunch is that our self-worth in this country is connected to our productivity, and in a lot of ways, we don't know how to begin to live simply, and what's more, we're afraid of it. Dan?
I feel increasingly uncomfortable referring to the United States as a Christian nation.
Okay.
And more clear about what American civil religion is. and which does use some Christian language and some Christian symbols when it's convenient. And the whole, I mean, I look at the 80s at, you know, with Reagan as the high priest, and remember his acceptance speech of the Republican nomination, in which his big promise to American citizens was that our teenagers would not have to stop cruising in their cars after school. And that this would, you know, this was their right. As, you know, I mean, and it's all kind of, I mean, it's not. And that won, you know, that won the leadership.
Yeah, here.
You know, there's a lot of sort of this Minnesota Lutheran guilt or something about the U.S. being the source of a lot of problems, and the U.S. is a source of a lot of problems, and there's a lot that the U.S. is accountable for. But if you give someone in South Korea or Taiwan or Japan or China or Thailand the opportunity to develop their economy and live higher on the food chain and consume more, they do. Mm-hmm. So I think while we are accountable for a lot, the U.S. or America should not be simplistically sort of the source of all the world's problems.
Okay. Reactions to that? Other comments? Yeah.
I was in Thailand in the last week, and it's incredible the change is happening there. Bangkok is the largest city in Thailand. There's 6 million people there. The second largest city is Chiang Mai. There's only a few over 100,000. And as in every place in the third world, I think the urbanization of the third world is a result of the capitalization, which sets up industrial plants, and they need cheap labor to work. So people are making $3-4 a day at the expense of, I feel like it's my system, the capitalist system, more so than it's my country, it's my system that's jammed down their throat, like it or not.
Well, the systems is, you know, you can say the U.S. is sort of forcing everybody to absorb the European or American model, but you can also look at Taiwan that, you know, has many programs to bring in capital, to exclude, to transfer jobs from the United States to Taiwan. And look at Korea, where, you know, the market business, the dairy business, you know, consumption of, let's say, milk in the late 70s was 2 liters per capita, and today it's over 14 liters per capita. So who is right to say that the Koreans should drink less milk and live better? You know, it's a tough call.
I think, the last couple of words you use, let me just throw out, what does that mean to live better? I think that somehow is central to what we're talking about. And if other countries are beginning to emulate a high consumption lifestyle, is that a proof that it's a better lifestyle? No.
I have a friend that went through the Depression. He said he didn't know he was poor until somebody told him.
I think we're so well endowed and it's so well ingrained in us, our capitalistic system, that it's very difficult for us to think of alternatives. And I think that's partly where our problem lies, is that, you know, we look at other countries that are developing just like us, you know, look at Japan, and we envy them. I mean, they've really taken it and run with it. And yet we don't seem to be able to look beyond that or turn around and look behind and see, now, what are there other ways that we could survive? I mean, there are other systems, but we've
You know, I think that's a very good, you know, transition comment, and I'm going to just assume for a minute, for the sake of discussion, and if I'm way off base, you know, take me back, but for the sake of discussion, I'm going to assume that we would all like a sustainable planet. We would like a lifestyle on this planet that all people in the globe could share, and that would not only sustain life equally, but would sustain the planet as well. one of the things, and I believe that we can come up with ideas to promote that, but as a prerequisite to that, I think that we need to ask ourselves two questions. What will it cost us to change towards that sustainable lifestyle? And the flip side of that is, what will it cost us not to change? And if you would, again, for the sake of other learning styles, turn to some neighbors around you and talk about those two questions. What will it cost us to change to a more sustainable lifestyle? And what will it cost us if we don't? Why don't you have some of those more private discussions? We'll bring it back to the big group in a couple of minutes.
Well, this may be an insignificant point, but you mentioned living better.
Could you speak
what we're
up,
talking about, what we're talking about is somebody telling us you live better. And how that occurs, I think, is through communications and the mass media that we're subjected to, the advertising to television. And I think without that, it would be a basket. If they didn't tell us we needed microwave ovens and new cars and things like that, I think.
So you're saying that part of them.
We would still maintain a quality of life, but we would be subjected to this craving to buy and spend and consume, which only feeds the industrial complex of the United States and has a tendency to put capital and control of power into a smaller group and concentrate power and therefore augmenting the situation, making it worse.
You know, I think that's an excellent point. The notion of a capitalistic society is that you have to create need in order to sell goods. And one of the things that often gets picked on is our frail human self-perceptions. You know, if I think that, for instance, you know, a couple of years ago when I realized that there was aluminum in deodorant as one of the chief ingredients and that's being linked to Alzheimer's, I decided I was going to stop using deodorant and really worried for a while. I mean, you know, am I going to lose my friends and stuff? You know, we create needs for us, real or unreal, and it's difficult to sort those out. I think one of the points you're making is that to make change, we really need a supportive community around us who can help us to stem the tide of the market economy that convinces us that at times we have needs that we may not really have. Excellent point. Yeah.
One point that I can see is that we would like to have change without pain. And without inconvenience and without the change of our lifestyle, but we would like to have change, and I would prefer that you change.
Yeah. Make it better, right? Yeah.
You know, it's ironic though, when I think of being in Holden, all the clothes I need for the next 2 years are with me right now in my suitcase. I don't feel I'm in need. And yet if I go home, I got a whole closet full of other clothes that I don't need. Okay. My need is to live more simply, frankly. My need is to live in a smaller house, so we got less to clean and all of that.
I just realized I called on 3 men in a row, so.
My thought is that all of these situations that we're talking about are symptomatic of a much greater ill that I think is plaguing all of us. And unfortunately, it's the hardest to change. And that is, you know, within each of us, that we sort of become disconnected from our own spirituality, our own sheer vision, and everything else is an end product of that. Our ability to take look at a situation and determine, is this just, or this is this for the betterment? I mean, what was, and looking at the logical consequences of things. I mean, I think that we're so consumed with this monolithic myth that we've created for ourselves that we don't even know the nature of the beast. I mean, we're moving ahead full speed without any regard to the consequences later down the road. And I mean, the Native American tradition of planning 7 generations in the future is a very sound one.
I can't help but promote this book after that comment. The structure of scientific revolutions helps us to think about that very notion that somehow when we're wrapped up in a current model of living, what Kuhn calls a paradigm, it's difficult to step outside that paradigm and critique it and say, how would things be if they were different? And that kind of cultural objectivity is what we all need, I think, to stem the tide here. And I would recommend this to you. It sounds ominous, but it's a classic, and I would recommend it to you if you want to begin to think in terms of paradigms. Mary, and then here.
Oh, I just... I want to kind of respond to what, I don't know your name over here, but what you're saying about, I've had the same reaction while I've been at Holden. I'm living very differently than I live in, and the economy is so different. It's a village economy. And same reaction to the clothes and my other needs, they're really being met. And I'm discovering that this village economy really meets human needs. And and also deep spiritual needs and also material needs in a way that our larger society doesn't. And that really, I think that what we have to gain, you know, the original question was what's it going to cost us and what are we going to get back? And I think that what it's going to cost us is getting those fixes on those artificial created addictive needs of our society, the cars, and the more and more, they're faster and shinier and more expensive. And we're going to gain a deeper human satisfaction.
I want to come back to the gain idea in just a minute, but there was a hand over here. Yeah.
I spent some time at a place called Arco Santi in Arizona. Mm-hmm. And it's a concept of an architect named Paolo Soleri, and he uses the term arcology, which is architecture and ecology. And he has this theory that we need to have, instead of having everything, there's access by transportation, which is what we live now, and that's having cars and having suburbs. And he grew up in an Italian walled city where everything was accessed by proximity. So you lived by where you worked, you walked everywhere, you could, you know, ride your bike, whatever. And he said, I mean, and there's two things. First of all, the car in our culture is a huge environmental just elephant, you know, white, whatever. It's just an awful thing. And then also, in terms of the culture, it separates us so much. We live in these suburban houses, very distant from our next door neighbor. We don't even know our next door neighbor. And, you know, which was very much opposed to the little town that he grew up in, where everybody lived next door to each other and knew each other. And so I think the car is one thing we could do without.
And you're really talking about, I think what's being talked a lot more in big cities is regional planning, creating regional centers around which communities can be built away from the megalopolis and back to smaller, identifiable, knowable communities. Yeah.
What I had tonight, what if the only addiction the world had was to ice cream after church?
That's great to me. I want to come back to Mary's point. I'm amazed at how quickly this hour goes with so many, you know, energetic and concerned people. Mary's notion of, if we've just begun to examine what are the costs of not changing, what are the costs of changing, I think we also need to spend a little time on what are the gains, and Mary really gave me an insight I just ask you to dwell on for a minute. What do you experience here in the village that sometimes you just wish you could take home with you? What's a gain that you have here?
I was just thinking about how, for me working here, you know, I don't get out and do that much hiking here. Mm-hmm. You know, the wonderful thing about Holden, you know, it's not the mountains. It's the community, you know, and how we could live in a Christian community. I mean, why can't we all just go do this? Yeah. I think that the only
Well, that won't take up too much time.
Good point. Christian community for you, yeah.
I think one of the things I've noticed most would be, and not that's much what I've gained, but it's, you know, what I don't have to contend with here. Which is, of course, a lot of things, but one of them that's most dramatic to me is the lack of competition. You know, I got to have a bigger car, I've got to go faster, and you have to dress better, and you have to look nicer, and you have to have more money, and you have to... And it seems like no matter with competition, and to have a feeling of total lack of competition is one of those positive gains. And then it goes forth from that, and you feel like you have to consume less because you don't have to compete as much.
Mm-hmm. 10-second silence for those of you that are thinking about saying something and don't have your hand up. Someone who hasn't spoken, yeah.
One thing that I came from here, and I've never been to Holden before, was a sense of hope. For I've always felt so many frustrations with so many different issues on different topics that after talking to people, gives me a different perspective on things that I'm hoping to take back, and it gives me a sense of hope that hopefully I can take that back to people, and especially being a teacher,
wow.
To take that back to my students, because my students feel a very high level of frustration with, we always give the bad view of everything that's happened to our environment and everything, and bringing back a sense of hope also to my students that it's not a hopeless case, that there are things that we can do, because when you talk about the changes that people have to make, a lot of the changes are not that hard to do. And just talking to everyone here, that's the biggest thing I've gotten from all of this.
Thank you. Yeah.
As somebody who's lived at home for a while, one of the things I noticed is I'll go to put on some clothes that just feel incredibly overdressed here. And I feel like everybody is just going to notice and look at. And I can take that same item of clothing out with me and think, oh, this will be great to take out. And I get out there and it's like, suddenly I have this pressure that it rags. people are joking. I've told people here that oftentimes I felt out there that we walk around and especially me kind of saying, hi, my name is Jackie, how do you like me so far? And feeling like, you know, that the pressure here is to not wear makeup, not look as alternative as you can, and there's a lot of support for that. And I don't know, I don't feel that. Somebody probably who's pretty sensitized to external things, probably. That's one thing I appreciate.
Here and then right there.
That the workplace is not so separate from the really important things. Working in the laundry, we've been within 4 days, a support group, a listening group, really fine ideas from really fine people. We still get our work done, but it's very, very nicely integrated, and you know, that's certainly not the case in most work situations.
Two comments here and then in the back.
I think one of the most liberating things for me is not having a telephone. The telephone is like the bane of my existence at home. I have an answering machine at work, and I have an answering machine at home, and there's like all these phone calls that I have to be returning. And when I realize that, it gets me. There's a lot of pressure in that, but there's also a real centeredness that I felt here. When I work in the pottery shop some here and reinforce that kind of feeling that I can just be doing what I'm doing right now. And the phone is one of these things in my life which is always taking me away, and in the middle of one task now I'm off to another one is always, and so it's kind of a centering and just doing one thing at a time that I'm enjoying here.
Terrific.
I was just going to say the only thing I'm disturbed about with this, the last few minutes of the discussion, is that we have to be in this position of privilege to even be having this discussion about how we could
Excellent
live more
point.
Simply. There's plenty of people that I know and work with who are on AFDC and with more simply than they ever want to. They have very simple houses, they have very little heat, they have very little food, they have no medical care, and these people live within a few miles of us. And I think if these people were here having the same discussion to talk about, you know, hope and why I don't disagree with these things, and there's a link between what we do and what happens to other people. There's another whole side of people in this country and certainly in the world that's just not being represented here.
Excellent point. It reminds me of a comment that was made earlier in the week by someone who said, you know, let's not mistakenly romanticize poverty. Mm-hmm. You know, and can we continue to distinguish between poverty and oppression and simplicity? And I think there's a difference. Al, and then back here.
I frequently would like to be three people. One would face the issues of the ecosphere, which I think are overwhelming and may cause all this discussion to be for naught, because it will so transform the world that we haven't any idea of what it will be like, particularly if we get more and more poverty and more haves and have-nots, and we become an armed camp. Think of Mexico with 187 million, they've got 73 million, we'll have more than a Berlin Wall, all that kind of stuff. Second is poverty. I really don't know what to do about poverty, and I've faced it for a number of years in the community in which I live. I don't know. Nobody knows what to do about the poverty of the world and the poverty of this country. And somehow that ought to be addressed. And the third person I'd like to be would be to start a community of about 3,000 or 4,000 people on 4,000 or 5,000 acres, and a relative self-sufficient community in which the pressures to have would be almost eliminated, but you couldn't get rid of some pressures, but the pressures would be to play and to dance and to sing and to write poetry and to work in the organic gardens and learn to sew and learn to do all the things that you could learn to support yourself and be related to each other. The only problem with that I see is the need for medical, this only system that I think we really need is the medical system. I haven't quite figured out how to get rid of the medical system.
In the back, thanks for your patience.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to have free expression on volatile type subjects without having to feel threatened, fearful, defensive, and big arguments and fights on the floor and people walking off. And, you know, it really is nice.
One of the other games of Holden for you.
Yeah.
Am I missing anybody upstairs?
Yes.
Oh. Well, this was way back. I just wanted to confirm some of the comments that I was hearing over here about hope when we go back home. And I think that in an atmosphere like this, it's easy for all of us to kind of nod our heads and go, oh, this is so great. You know, we all love each other. We want to make the world all better, you know, smile happy, you know, and feel hopeful. And that is good. But I think that we need to remember 2 weeks from now, 2 days from now, a month from now, whatever, when we go home, that we are still that same person that was here at Holden, and we still have that knowledge that we gained here. And though we may not have the support at home that we do have here, we are still that person who's been convicted, you know, and who has those deep feelings about so many of these issues. And we can be heard, each of us, whether we're school teachers, nurses, pastors, or secretaries. You know, there is somebody there every day in our life that we can touch. And I think that we do need to remember that when we leave here.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I think another, you know, exceptional transition comment, because I'd like to spend the last 10 or 12 minutes in the discussion, if we could, talking about that very issue. And I'd like to, I guess, help that along just by sharing two quick concepts. One is, and these aren't fashioned in a final form for me, so I just throw them out to you as kind of experiments. One of the thoughts I have is, can we borrow from Bonhoeffer the boldness of costly grace and begin to think about costly stewardship and costly lives? What are those about in this day and age? If we were to examine costly stewardship, what does it mean that we give up? What does it mean that we give? Second one is the difference between I spoke earlier in the week about how leadership has changed. Leadership in this country at the turn of the century was leadership for a great society. And around the 1940s, the business sector began taking responsibility for the leadership model. And the leadership model's bottom line changed from the development of great societies to the development of dollars. And what we have now in this country is what I would call, and a guy named James McGregor Burns calls, transactional leadership, which is basically the training of managers and leaders, this is the key point, to maintain the status quo for a chosen few. That's the role of management. That's the role of the people who we work with, maybe who we are. And I think we need to look at it on that level as well. Burns also offers us another alternative, what he calls transformational leadership, which is changing the structures that oppress for the common good. And I would like to think that all of us can be transformational leaders when we go back home. And if you would, last small conversation, spend a couple minutes talking with three or four people, and everybody gets one turn at telling someone in that group what's one thing you'll do when you go home to, if you are convicted, what's one thing that you'll do? And make it a small thing. What's one thing you'll do to contribute to the development of this sustainable community that I think probably all of us want? And make it a simple thing that you will do, and promise to the group that you're talking to that you in fact will do it. And then we're gonna hear from about 15 or 20 of you, get an idea of some of the things that people are gonna try to do.